Good afternoon. Today is Thursday, March 22nd, 2018, and we're in the conference room at Raven Landing, and I'm here with Carl Benson. He's agreed to share his story with us for the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project, and this interview will go up to the university for their oral history project also. We'll start with a little biographical information. Can you tell us where and when you were born?
Well, I was born in Minnesota in June 1923. And my grandparents all came from Sweden, so my parents both spoke Swedish as a first language, and I was raised in a pretty much Swedish community. Mm-hmm. I went to high school in Minneapolis. All my schooling was there. And then these were the war years when I was in high school, so all the boys were either facing draft or enlisting, and I enlisted in the Navy and was able to finish to go through to graduate and then went right off to boot camp. And I learned a lot about aviation. This is why I selected a naval aviation program, and I ended up as an aviation machinist mate. After the war, I went to the University of Minnesota and decided within the first year that I was interested in both science and the earth, and so geology just looked like the major for me. So I majored in geology with minors in mathematics and physics, and had an excellent education. I finished there in 1950.
Okay.
So then my first field experience was in northern Alaska, in the northern foothills of the Brooks Range. That was with the U.S. Geological Survey. And one of my colleagues at the university had recommended me to George Gritch, and George Gritch was an alum of the university. He was also in charge of the Navy Oil Unit, which started during the war when the Navy wanted to get some idea of how much oil they had in the biggest of all naval petroleum reserves. That was Petroleum Reserve Number 4. And so we were doing the fundamental basic reconnaissance geology, and it was about the most exciting thing that I could think of, and most others did too. I'd always wanted to come to Alaska and to the north in general. I indicated that when I was in the Navy, so they promptly sent me to the tropics. And that's the way they work. After I finished with the first field season, 1950, which was really an exciting time, we walked and used weasels to do the reconnaissance geology between tracks that had been measured and studied along the river courses from up in the Brooks Range down to the Colville River. So we moved between these areas to fill in and studied and were able to work right on the air photos that were taken in 1949, and we used them in 1950. After I finished that field season, which was still lingers one of the best experiences I've had, I went back to the university for graduate work and I laid out a plan that I wanted to get field experience and do my graduate work, and in a 10-year period, finish my PhD. That worked, but one thing I didn't include in my plans at all, I didn't even think of, was that I'd be 10 years older at the end of 10 years. That hit me as a total surprise, I guess. Anyway, I worked with the Snow, Ice, and Permafrost Research Establishment. The nickname was SIPRE, S-I-P-R-E. That turned into the Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab, which has a a facility here out at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks, and its headquarters now is in Hanover, New Hampshire. When I was with the parent organization that was based in First University of Minnesota, and then it moved to Illinois, but when they were in Minnesota, I started to work with them as a graduate assistant and had a part-time job with the organization, which turned full-time, and I was with them basically from 1950 to 56. My graduate studies were really carrying on at the same time, but the field work that I got more and more involved in led me to join the organization full-time, and I worked at the Central Sierra Snow Lab, learned a lot about snow and the layering and the stratigraphy of snow, and as a geologist, this is just one more geologic formation to me. I went from the first field season to Greenland in 1952, and this was, I guess the chief scientist wanted me, his wife liked me to go along because I was big, and was supposed to take care of the boss. We had a great experience. The first reason we went there was to see about establishing radar stations out on the Greenland ice sheet that would protect the Thule Air Base, which at that time was called Blue Jay and was a secret base, except that everybody knew about it. And after working on this problem for a while, I discovered the layering, that I wanted to pursue that more after the first field season. Went back in 1953 and was able to go out to roughly 250 miles from Thule. We repeated this in 54, and I was starting to get a real feel for the stratigraphy and how to determine annual accumulation units in the snow. So as I was about ready to go back to graduate school, I thought, here's what we really ought to do. And I laid out a plan. And Bader, Henri Bader, who was the chief scientist at CIPRI at the time, liked it. He brought it to the chief of engineers, Corps of Engineers in Washington. They accepted what I wanted to do and told me I could have all the conditions I had laid out for doing it. So I canceled my beginning graduate, or returning to graduate school for another year, and finished up in 1955. That was a long expedition in Greenland. We were 120 days underway without seeing anyone else but the five other people on the expedition. But we managed to get a lot of good work done, and I used that for my PhD dissertation when I went back to Caltech in Pasadena. And my advisor was a professor that I first met at the University of Minnesota. He was there in the geology department and left there to go to Caltech, and by the time I was with him, he was in charge of the whole geological sciences division there. And it was a wonderful experience as far as my own broadening. And when I finished there, well, first I should say I had some exposure to some outstanding teachers and really inspirational people. One in mathematics that I corresponded with until he died a few years ago, and another one who left Minnesota, went to Texas. He taught me one thing I've always remembered, and that is when you're ever working on an outcrop, you're mapping, you're measuring, and you're trying to describe it, and you photograph it. But before you leave it, he said, take another look at it, and then tell yourself, I'll never see this again, ever. And then go back and check, have you got everything you need? And I thought of that every time I did one of these pit studies in Greenland. You'll never see this again. Get it right. And the inspirational people that I met on the faculty made a big difference. And I also suffered the loss of two when Joseph McCarthy was running wild with his craziness. He actually destroyed two professors that I was taking courses from. One of them was the brother of Robert Oppenheimer. It was Frank Oppenheimer. And he was a brilliant physicist at University of Minnesota. And they caught him up on something when he was a young man in the 20s, 30s, when everything was all mixed up. He had experimented, gone to some of these meetings of the communists, the socialist people. Well, he'd forgotten all about this, but that came back, and they actually fired him during the time I was taking physics from him. We had three professors that joined into this course: Weinberg, Joseph Weinberg, and Frank Oppenheimer were both fired from the university during my basic physics course, and that left an impression on me that made me pretty sour on this right-wing extremism from then on. Well, after my graduating from Caltech, I should say that before I went to Caltech, I added a wife. This is Ruth. I met her in 1950. She came in there. In 1952, we met on a train. I was leaving from the lab to go out to Minnesota and then on to Reno, Nevada, which was the base for our lab in the Sierras. She was there. We both met on the train platform, and as she points out, I didn't have much to say. We spent the night on the train, and the next morning I had been rehearsing a line, so I asked her, do you go to Minnesota, to Northwestern? And she said yes and told me about her work as a student nurse based at Evanston Hospital through Northwestern University. Well, I said, I got her phone number. She didn't think I'd call her, but I did. And we kept something going there from 52 until we married in 55. And now we have three children and four grandchildren, and they're all right here in Fairbanks.
Is there anything you would like your children to know about your career? Anything you'd like to, you know, other than what you've told me, anything you'd like to tell them about your work?
I think the main thing that I found when I came to Fairbanks is that I was with the Geophysical Institute. The work that I had done in Greenland got me interested in high altitude or places where I could do studies in the dry snow region where there's never any melting. And the best place that Terry Moore, who was the second president of the university, pointed out was the summit of Mount Wrangell. You got a huge flat area there in the caldera. And I got involved with that and found immediately that, of course, we knew it was a warm volcano. The North Crater was showing signs of a lot of volcanic heat around the rim. And we built a hut based on the rim to actually use the volcanic heat to heat it. Worked out fine until the activity changed after the big 1964 earthquake. The volcano essentially ate up the hut. It gases came inside. The nails and screws that were holding the panels together all rusted out, and it's useless right now. But I also found that to do field work in Alaska, especially glaciological work that I was interested in, you were competing with people that could come in from the outside and operate from a base where it's a lot cheaper and operate in the field at not much more expense than you had. So I started working on projects that depended on you being here through the winter. And that included the seasonal snow cover, which had not been studied at all. And then the ice fog, there's a ice crystallization project, a problem that involved rapid crystallization from exhaust sources, and that turned into be quite a problem of its own. And then I took on a study of underwater ice formation in turbulent streams. In a normal lake, you'll form an ice cover perhaps a month before the little streams freeze, and that's involved with the amount of supercooling that takes place. Water always supercools before it comes back up to 0 degrees to freeze. And we started looking at the literature on research done on stream freezing and found we had just some ideal setups here to work on. So I worked with several students on projects to measure the temperatures in the water under the stream and how it behaves through the whole winter. And then you add layers of ice through the winter on these streams. And we studied the layering and the petrofabrics, that is the orientation of the main optic axis of the crystals in the layering. But we also found that using the electrical conductance of the water, you could measure the amount of ice that formed, say, in a single night. We'd form 10% of the water would turn to ice all on the bottom of the stream. It looks like cauliflower. You can kick this loose with a stick or your hands, and it'll float up to the surface. That was a fascinating little project of its own. But I went back to Greenland, and from here also took a project, or wanted to do some studies in the Antarctic, and found a place at Bird Station, which had the same rate of accumulation, same mean annual temperature as the northeast or northeast part of my traverse in Greenland. So I compared by going to the Antarctic. I was at Bird Station, Pole Station, and then the Roosevelt Island out on the Ross Ice Shelf. But at Bird Station, the Seabees had constructed big vertical walls that I could study in making the station. So I was able to compare that with the station in Greenland. I wanted to go back there, but we had some problems, and this is I had left Ruth's home alone. It was one of the worst winters we've had on record. It had been pleasant the year before, but this is 61 and 62. And that convinced me, after she had a lot of trouble through the winter, and including raising two little mm-hmm. girls and having a problem with a pregnancy and a miscarriage, I decided I couldn't work in the Antarctic anymore as long as I was based here. And things have changed. Now people can travel down there easier. When I was there were no such thing as email. You couldn't mm-hmm. communicate by radio. It was a long nail slice. It was a too big and long-term isolation. Mm-hmm. So that's my field work.
That's what you want to pass on to your kids, a little bit about your work?
Well, they get a little idea there. And, of course, I've met and worked with some fantastic fellow faculty members and graduate students. And the thing that brought us to Raven Landing, in Ruth and I both had problems that needed some surgeries, and we weren't able to stay in our house. Our kids took over and said, "You can't stay here," and we moved into Raven Landing, sold the house, and we've been here. That was we sold the house in 2014, mm-hmm. And been here since, and I'd say this has been very handy.
How's your experience been here?
The experience here is really good. It takes away so much of the responsibility, for example, of home ownership and maintenance, but it also provides us a base that's where maintenance is taken care of. They feed us once a day, just like you do with sled dogs, and it's worked out fine.
They have a couple questions in here we didn't get a chance to ask.
Sure.
They wanted to know maybe what your fondest memory of your life has been, some of your fondest memories.
Well, it's hard. They're all so fun.
Yeah, I know.
I'd say I've really enjoyed field work in areas where nobody has ever been before. It's hard on this planet to get the kind of peace and quiet that I had in the field 60 or 50,
what
60
gift,
years
really,
ago.
What a gift, really, you know, to be somewhere where no one else has been. I mean,
and,
what a gift.
And there's a whole feeling, the field work that is done now and the field work that I did was progressively more efficient than what had gone before. The USGS used to go up into the mountains, be up in the Brooks Range waiting for the melt. They do geologic mapping. When the melt came and the streams opened, they would take fold boats, canvas boats, load things into it, and go down the stream to the Colville River and over to Umiut, which was the base. But that was, there's a nice book written on that called The Silent River. It's by one of the people who was with George Gritsch when they did this in 1945. And people think, well, it must be nice, ride down in a boat down the river. Actually, they're wading in it hip deep, pulling the boat most of the time, and loading it with rocks and carrying a stove and lots of stuff. And it was very exciting stuff, and it took a long time. We, on the other hand, were able to be out for a period of, it was 5 months. And it's hard to come by field. Nowadays, people want to go to a site with a helicopter, do what you want to do, and then leave. In the days, and some of the geologists that I know, and one, Bob Detterman, had been in almost every place you can imagine in Alaska, and the Park Service got him and I joined him to discuss World Heritage Sites here in Alaska. And we talked about the hot springs in the Saddle of Rochette Mountains. And Bob said, well, they're not really that hot. They had camped there for a while, and they had worked on both sides of it and come down. He knew all about the area. You have a hard time finding people that have not only been in the area, but slept in it, walked in it, and been in it, lived in it for months at a time. That, now we've gone to the point where our consideration of time is such that we want to do everything fast. Mm-hmm. And I think we've lost something there.
Yeah, I'm sure. A fun and final question. What was your favorite age and why? What time of life?
Well, I've kind of enjoyed life
all the way along.
That's hard to answer. I don't know. I had a marvelous time when I was exposed to new ideas at the University of Minnesota, the same at Caltech, marvelous experiences with other people there. And I've enjoyed the field work I've done, and I've worked with some outstanding students and fellow in the field. And I got a family of great kids, and I haven't found anyone I'd trade Ruth for.
Oh,
so,
what a peach she is.
So that's, it's hard to answer. What you know, you can't say, well, this is it.
Especially when you've had such a fortunate good life. The whole thing has been
I probably am the luckiest man in the world.
Well, I think you might be.
Thank you.
So I thank you for your time and your story, and I appreciate the opportunity to get a little more time with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.